This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte has a history that is sometimes difficult to spot, but it's there. Preserving that history can be a challenge and an important one to conquer because history can fade away unless you preserve it. Award-winning author and journalist Ron Stodgill has been working on that. In a follow-up to his book, Let There Be Light, in 2014, he is about to release 10 Men Exploring the Passion and Progress of Black Men on Charlotte's Historic West Side. It's an oral history celebrating the lives of change agents working to strengthen one of the city's oldest African-American communities. Ron Stodgill has moved away from Charlotte, unfortunately, but he joins us by phone for the hour. Welcome back, Ron. Good to talk to you again.
Oh, great being here, Mike.
This is part of an effort by Johnson C. Smith University President Ron Carter to provide a written record of the present, and I quote him here, so that future generations can understand the factors shaping their lives from a different lens than the traditional narrative. So how does this book and your previous work, also a part of this project, differ from the traditional narrative?
So Dr. Carter's vision when he brought me into the university was to create a volume of books that just explore the history and the progress of the Northwest Side. Some, you could say, lack of progress as well. And all sorts of conversations that would sort of land in the policy realm to create real change. And so, I mean, I think that's one of the roles of not just the university, but the historically black college is to, you know, not only preserve history, but start dialogue and discussion about what's happening in the community around it. And we wrote an anthology. I edited this anthology, Let There Be Light, a couple of years ago. And Tom Hanchett from the New South, Levine Museum of the New South, the historian, he's former, but he's still very active. He wrote the intro. And in that intro, Mike, there were so many references to African-American men who played vital roles in creating that community, building that community. And we wondered where that narrative diverged and where would we find that same participation amongst African-American men, because they've been characterized not as sort of assets in the community, you know, in the media, but just kind of missing persons, and we just knew that not to be true. And so we set out to do kind of a more contemporary look at African-American men as assets in the community and kind of as an antidote to the sound bites that reduce them to almost either respondents or caricatures or something that is not particularly positive. So we wanted to just air it out, give them the mic, so to speak, and let them hold forth.
So that answers that first question, I guess. So that what you're saying is that the traditional narrative leaves these people out, and so you are putting them in. And I guess it kind of partially answers what was going to be my next question, which is why only men?
Well, I mean, we cannot obviously minimize the role of African-American women. You know, African-American women have been partners in our building of community. And obviously, there's lots of narrative around how they lead the way and, you know, and a characterization almost that we live in a almost a matriarchal community, but we're present. We're sort of always present, and you know what, we need to tell our own story. So, as a journalist, as an African American male with three sons, and happened to be at Smith, you know, that just became a project in which I had a lot of passion for. Obviously, the news converges with that. You know, the death of African American men at the hands of law enforcement, you know, right there in Charlotte even, you know, obviously gave momentum to a project that Dr. Carter and I had been talking about.
You're highlighting the lives through their own words of 10 men who have made a difference on Charlotte's West Side. We're going to meet a few of them in a few minutes here who have told their stories. And most of the people in this book, in the course of telling their stories, don't sugarcoat it, and they don't leave out the less than attractive parts of themselves. They're pretty honest about a lot of things that might be uncomfortable for many people to talk about in a forum like this or in a publication that will be on library shelves and bookshelves and there forever. During the riots last year, a lot of people were said they were surprised by the undercurrent of unrest that was manifest by those riots. When you read these stories and you hear some of the things that these men overcame in their lives, would that help you to understand that undercurrent for those who did not or have not yet overcome those adversities?
I believe so. I mean, part of my role was to find the men in the community in which I thought could kind of represented the broad spectrum of voices, just not only of overcoming obstacles, but triumph and sharing and you know, and changing communities. I believe that absolutely, you know, Charlotte as a city, it's a banking city. Its preoccupation is with commerce. There's been social issues and, that have been swept under the rug. And, you know, I gave a forum. I'd like to maybe hear from some of the, you know, the gentlemen in the book on that. I mean, they might be able to articulate that even better than me.
Well, I'll bring them in. If you want me to, I'll bring them into the conversation because we have several people with us, or two people with us today. Colin Pinckney is the executive director of Harvest Center of Charlotte and the founder of We Are World Class Book Club for male high school students, which we'll talk a little bit about as we go through this program. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Daryl Williams is a Charlotte architect and founding partner of Neighboring Concepts. That's a firm focusing on improving quality of life. He's also former county commissioner and 2017 winner of the Charlotte Post Foundation's Luminary Lifetime Achievement Award. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
More welcome. So pick up on that. You both share your stories. Both of your stories have low points in them in terms of the things that you were experiencing in your life and some of the mistakes that you admit to making in that life. When you read your stories, when you read the other eight men who are in this book, for those people who have not yet overcome certain things, who are still making the kinds of mistakes that you admit to making, could this be a beacon, a way out? Could it be a way for others who have not experienced that to understand what's going on? Begin with you, Colin.
Yeah, I sure hope so. You know, I was fortunate, and I'm grateful to Ron and Dr. Carter for including me in this great work. At the time Ron approached me, you know, there was a very pivotal situation in my life where my older brother, Bill Pinckney, passed away, and it was a really emotional time for me because my brother, like many men of color, who's my older brother, struggled with a lot of the realities in the world that black men tend to struggle with.
Your brother went through what a lot of young people go through today that we don't really think about very often if we're not in that situation. Your brother was forced, essentially, to become the man of the house.
He was.
At 14.
At 14 years old, because of the absence of my father, my older brother Bill was dubbed man of the house. Mm-hmm. And we still see that happening today. And
it's a burden on a 14-year-old boy.
It's a burden that it's pretty heavy. Mm-hmm. And
how did he cope with that?
Well, we saw Bill coping with his own realities in terms of the power struggle that brought him. There was a lot of pride for him in that. But there was also the struggle, the reality that a 14-year-old boy trying to manage six, seven other siblings without the guidance of a strong male presence was a lot to deal with. And unfortunately, he, like a lot of young men, cope by using drugs and alcohol, mm-hmm. which led later to life to other negative realities. And yet all the while growing up watching Bill as my big brother, I took a great sense of pride that he took on that challenge, mm-hmm. Even where we saw him failing. And it wasn't until he passed away that I got to really examine what was really going on with Bill, and as a result, what was going on with our family,
right.
and the community we lived in, and realizing the burden he bore, but also the great light he brought to us and his family through his artwork.
Right.
You know, Bill was an accomplished artist, and he, you know, he gave us a lot of pride and joy as a family with all the pain he brought. Mm-hmm. You know, it was this weird intersection of good and bad. Mm-hmm. And it led me to a hard decision late in my life, which was part of my agony in his passing. I had made a decision that I would pull away because for most of my adult life, I had to deal with and bear the brunt of a lot of his negative realities. And I made a decision for me and my family that I needed to separate from that. And at his passing, I realized that it wasn't so much just his inability to cope well with his own struggles, but it was also the fact that in that he was healing, and he was healing us as a family.
And healing through his artwork.
Through his artwork in an incredible way.
Yeah.
He painted black art, black life. He worked as an architect apprentice, and that's why I respect Darryl. And yet he always felt underaccomplished. Mm. And yet my brother is the first African-American man to have his artwork hung at Duke University.
Wow.
And he, for most of his life, felt like an underachiever.
I guess the same question has to go to you to give you equal time here, Darryl, and that is what can people learn, not only people who are in the struggle, but people who are removed from that struggle, who have no idea that that kind of a struggle goes on in a human being's life. What can they learn from your story and others?
Well, I'm sitting here listening to Colin, and I'm getting emotional just listening to him, so I can't wait to read the stories of the other men in the book.
Hey, I want to point out, we just got this book 5 minutes before we started the show. I just want to point that out.
And yeah. Can I just point out before Darryl, I mean, Darryl as a county commissioner, as a face, you know, a very visible person in Charlotte, the book is full of accomplished men. But yet, you know, they were very generous in sharing. I was humbled to be part of that because you never know what you're going to get, you know, whether or not they're going to sort of, you're going to get a sanitized version that they, you know, is sort of a press release for whatever their kind of efforts and initiatives are in the community to help them build their career. But I just thought that they were vulnerable and,
yes.
and open, and I just wanted to bring that up. And Colin, that's an example there, and they're throughout the book. So
I only have 40 seconds left in this segment, Darryl. So
I cut Darryl off.
That's
I'm
all right.
Sorry.
Let me give you. Now we have 30 seconds. So let me give you your due for just a second. We'll come back on the other side and finish up.
Well, I think you know people see you as you are today, and they assume that you've been on a certain track. And I think my excitement about being in the book like this and sharing my past is to let people know where I came from and the truth about where I came from so young people could learn and really believe that they can become anything they want to be.
And we'll stop there and come back to you on the other side of the break at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hefner Financial of Charlotte. Jim Hefner is an independent fiduciary financial planner whose team specializes in retirement solutions and tax strategies. Information at youlljustknow.com. And Taylor Richards & Conger, a specialty shop for men, built and headquartered in Charlotte's Phillips Place, featuring European and American tailored and made-to-measure clothing and accessories. Details at trcstyle.com. Coming up on the local news roundup tomorrow, Charlotte Mayor Jennifer Roberts suffers a stunning upset plus surprising changes on city council. Our state avoids a direct hit from Hurricane Irma, but the storm still leaves its mark. 4 are killed in South Carolina. The week before the one-year anniversary of the Keith Scott shooting, and a judge orders the release of videos from the protests. And Charlotte says it's prime for Amazon. Our roundtable of reporters talks about those stories and more tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Asbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Democrats are now lining up for and against single-payer health care. Big push, big battle. We're on it. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
You can join On Point from 10 till noon following Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Ron Stodgill, author, journalist, and editor of a book called 10 Men, Examining the Passion and Progress of Black Men on Charlotte's Historic West Side. It was done at the behest of Dr. Ronald Carter, who is the president of Johnson C. Smith University, and it's the second in a series of books by Ron. He joins us by phone. Colin Pinckney and Daryl Williams are both in the studio. They are two of the 10 men in the book. Colin is executive director of Harvest Center of Charlotte. Daryl Williams, architect and founding partner of Neighboring Concepts. And we were talking about the stories in this book, Daryl Williams, that are revealing and honest, and they're out there, warts and all. When Ron came to you and said, I want to hear your story, did he say, I want to hear all the bad parts too? Or did you just feel that you needed to volunteer those, not unsavory, but those, the parts that would shed not necessarily a positive light on
your life? No, Ron did not emphasize that he wanted to hear the truth or anything like that. And I think Ron knows me well enough to know that I'm going to speak the truth. I'm going to share. I've always done that. And I always speak to youth and go to schools and try to be a good mentor. Mm-hmm. And I always share with them my background, because I think they can learn from that. If they know that I can become an architect or a county commissioner from where I've come from, that they can become anything they want to be. And so I don't try to sugarcoat that.
And there's a hunger for that. In your story, Colin, you talk about being asked for the first time to go into a school and just talk to kids. And you walked into an auditorium filled with young black men in a high school, I think.
That's right.
And they couldn't get enough of you. Why?
I was shocked at that, because, one, I'm not an educator, and I do a lot of speaking and things like that, and I work with young people in the community for a long time. But in that place, I was surprised that they were, one, allowed to do that. That was what shocked me at first.
Allowed to do what?
To have their own space, to share their thoughts and feelings in a kind of a non-academic setting. Mm-hmm. And that felt – that was – really refreshing for me. I didn't expect it. And I did, I think, like Daryl said, I just told him the truth, what I knew. And I talked about my family. I talked about the pain. I talked about the reality of growing up in a home without a father with eight other siblings and having to navigate our way through high school and college and court and all those things without a dad, and knowing the reality they were living, being able to relate that to them. And so I was shocked when they said, come back, because I didn't, again, I'd never been a part of anything like that.
Because a lot of people who don't know about their lives and don't think about their lives and what their lives must be like probably view these people as ne'er-do-wells, and they're not. They're just people who are in desperate, unfortunate circumstances, and if they could find a way out, they would take it.
I believe that. My brother's a prime example, and yet he was troubled most of his life. But and I have only understood this in his passing. Again, so I think about what other people must go through when they think they know what's going on. They think they understand why a person's acting out and behaving the way they do. And they look at just the surface issues. But, you know, when a young man, like a lot of young men in our community, experience trauma in their home. I mean, talk about trauma in the community is one thing. To talk about trauma, domestic violence, abuse in your home is a whole different reality. And I think what we do see consistently is our community tends to pay for that, where there's these deep issues for young men of color in their home, and they don't have a place to unpack that and to really deal with that. And then they go to school and they're told, learn, listen. And that's
one thing that struck me when I went to interview Colin was that you were invited into the school, and it was around sort of some healing that needed to be done, and your story had a healing effect. Isn't that right? Can you share that? It was after someone had been murdered, I believe. A big local story of a young woman. Is that right?
That's right. It was the story, and I forget the young lady's name now, but it actually made the Oprah Winfrey show. A young cheerleader at that school had been unfortunately killed at the hands of her boyfriend, her live-in boyfriend, and she was a bright light at that school, and it brought a darkness and a lot of misbehavior and acting out. And so again, I was amazed at the response that there was a calming effect that happened, and the fact that the boys in particular wanted to have more time with me and other men in our community who've been able to come and be a part of that.
So we're sitting here talking about some of the negative aspects of all of this, and in the preface to your book, Dr. Carter from Johnson C. Smith writes that in his time in Charlotte, he has heard, quote, conversations, read reports, and debated recommendations about black men that always seem to start from a deficit perspective, which is what we're doing here. The focus is on their deficits, problems, pathologies within their family and circumstances, and he finds that approach concerning because he says it marginalizes the strength of individuals. So in the collective, in the whole, as you take all of these 10 stories, this volume that you've written or edited reverses that, Ron?
I believe so. I mean, I think that there is a kind of mosaic that happens, you know, or almost a quilt. So you do take a lot of these patches that may are little stories, tales that may, as you say, might be unsavory or not positive. But when you stitch them together along with the other stories of triumph, you do get something that is quite profound. And so I think that the collective of hearing these men speak and tell their own stories, in the end, you do get a sense of redemption in the end. And so I actually believe that that this chorus that you don't hear much I'm hoping it will have a redemptive effect. Mm-hmm. It will be and these stories will be shared, and they will inspire.
These people
not
are all
African Americans, but the community overall.
These people are all described as change makers, all 10 of these men. How did you choose them?
Just, you know, I'm a reporter, you know, just good old fashioned shoe leather. There was nothing particularly scientific about it. I went out and I talked to people in the know, in the community, not just, you know, Indian chiefs, but your regular folk who've been touched by these folks in various quadrants of the community, whether or not it be in the barber shop or whether or not it be in a church pew or in a community center or in the school. And so we have or at Johnson C. Smith itself. So there are, there's a range of voices and generations. The only thing that they share in common is that they're men and that they've touched that side of the community.
Were either of you surprised to be included in this or to be asked to be included in this, Daryl?
Not really. I really wasn't sure exactly what it was. And, it's evolved into something that I didn't realize when Ron first asked me. And
this is my first time hearing that.
but I think it's become much more than I had anticipated. I think that he wanted to share my life story, and I think, like I said, I can't wait to read the other stories because I'm looking forward to learning from the other 9 men as well.
Colin?
Kind of a mixed bag for me. I think I was surprised because even for me, when I think about black men in this community, there are certain men that I immediately think of who are change makers.
Who would they be?
Well, I get in trouble because then I'll leave somebody off.
Never mind. All right, never mind.
And there goes, you know. But they're out there, and I talk about those men in closed circles, and when I'm in the barbershop, and I'm talking about sharing my own frustrations with what's going on in our community.
Dr. Carter, in his preface to this book, talks about that there's too much focus on the shortcomings of black men. I think that's individually, but mostly collectively in society at large, and that leads to what he calls misleading illusions about them. You would agree with that?
I would.
Yeah.
How do we fix that?
Well, I think sharing stories like what's in this book, I think, is a step in the right direction. I think that illusions may be, I think sometimes misunderstood.
Yeah.
And I think being able to share the whole story from where you started to where you are today, I think help ties it all together and can get rid of some of those illusions.
I'd agree with that, and I think also if there could be space, if this book opens up space in our community where we talk about young black men in process and not just at the beginning or at the end of the continuum of life, whether the beginning is a bad situation and the end is there, this famous architect, mm-hmm. right? And you miss everything in the middle. You never talk about it. That's what the book club gives me. I get to see the middle. Young boys who may be at risk of not finishing high school, and now boys who are graduating college and getting their master's degree. And nobody's telling the story.
Right.
Nobody's talking about those boys. And I think for me to get to do this, I get to say that, and that becomes part of the conversation.
When you look at anybody successful, you're looking at the end point, wherever they are in their lives. If they're successful, that's the end point, and no consideration is given to the struggles that may or may not have occurred along the way. And if you're looking at somebody in the midpoint, they're not yet where they might end up being. They are whatever they are at that moment in time. So this book shows you that there are options out there, and those options are good and bad. And you admit, Daryl, to making some bad choices along the way.
That's
how
right.
How did you see that in yourself and decide, I'm going to change. I'm going to take option B instead of the first option, easiest option.
I think it was, when I hear Colin talk about his brother, it reminds me of my dad. You know, because my dad grew up he had a very challenging life, and he didn't have a mother or father. And so it wasn't until later, as Colin mentioned, it wasn't until later when I understood why my dad was like he was. He became an alcoholic. He was a hard worker, a brick mason, but he died early in his 50s. From cirrhosis of the liver because of his drinking, you know. And it wasn't until later in life when I understood why he lived the way he did because of what he had to deal with as a young man, just lost, you know. And so I think God put the right people in my life at the right time and gave me enough common sense to connect those dots, you know. And I could have chosen either path.
These are 10 stories of 10 black men on the West Side, Ron. But when you read them, although some of it is particular to the African-American community and the kind of life that some people have to live as the result of years of prejudice and discrimination, etc., what comes through loud and clear is the humanness of this. This speaks to everybody, doesn't it, Ron?
Well, the idea was that these stories would serve as a prism to illuminate, you know, the struggles and promise of black men, you know, throughout this country who, you know, have kind of undergone the same sorts of transformations. And as a media guy, I mean, it's sort of not shocking that these stories would not be heard. I mean, it's always about sort of the means of distribution and how who gets to, you know, who the gatekeeper is in terms of telling your story. And right. And so, you know, these are, stories in which of black men that don't have the connection to media to be heard. And so I felt like it was my job to get some of those stories stories out there.
Ron Stogill is our guest. He's the editor of a book called 10 Men, Examining the Passion and Progress of Black Men on Charlotte's Historic West Side. And two of those men profiled in this book by telling their own oral histories are with us. And that would be Colin Pinckney and Darrell Williams. And this is about change makers. This is about people making a difference in the community. Do you think of yourselves as being change makers?
If I can say it without sounding arrogant, yes, I do.
Is that an intentional? In other words, if you're a change maker and you think of yourself that way, you're living that way. You're living that life intentionally.
On purpose, yeah. I get up every day with that intention to make a difference first in my family, mm-hmm. with my own wife and kids, and then also in this community, because the stories we talk about and have informed the opportunity there is to be a change maker. You know, you look at the tragedies and you could either become, you know, complacent or you could decide to do something about it. And I think too often we don't see men who kind of work in the shadows, who aren't looking for a platform, who just want to be, who want to make a change. So in that regard, I am, but not arrogantly. I just see the problem and I want to do something about it.
Yeah, I don't really think of myself as a change maker. I feel like I am, but I don't think about it that way. I just go about doing what I have passion for. Mm-hmm. And really that is to use the talent that I have gained to try to influence positive change in communities that, like the communities I grew up in. You know, and in a comprehensive way, and use my architectural skills to help transform these kind of communities.
The men you profile in this book run the gamut. There are artists in here. There are architects in here. There are literary people, entrepreneurs, with Charles Jones, who was supposed to be on the show, but who is too ill to be here, and we wish him well. He's been on the show many times in the past. He's a dyed-in-the-wool civil rights activist that goes right back to the beginnings of that movement. They're all over the gamut here, Don. Ron, were they difficult to find? Were they difficult to entice to share their stories?
No, I found them to be remarkably open. I mean, I think that, you know, we sat down and spent some good quality time together. What struck me was how the impact that they have had, that how their own biography has shaped Charlotte, and one example is Darrell and his, you know, the environment in which he grew up, where there were very few sort of recreational outlets, you know, and I think in his role as a civic leader has brought playgrounds. And can you talk a little bit about that, Darrell? I was fascinated by how the broader community of Charlotte is the beneficiary of something that one of Darrell's struggles back in Louisiana.
I'm going to let you come back on the other side because there's not enough time for you to go into that story at this point. So we'll come back on the other side of the break and do that, because this is part of your story that you talk about and ultimately led to your becoming a member of the county commission for a while here in Mecklenburg County. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting singer-songwriter John Prine. 45 years of music in the vein of Dylan, Springsteen, and Bonnie Raitt this Saturday at Belk Theater. Tickets at BlumenthalArts.org. And Tyndall Subaru, Gastonia, featuring the new Outback with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates actions to help avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com and on Facebook at Tyndall Subaru. Another healthcare push is underway in Washington, this one from former presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders. The Vermont senator is proposing Medicare for all, and some Democrats are supporting it. Bernie Sanders joins Tom Ashbrook on Point in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock to talk about the uphill climb ahead for single-payer insurance. Next Wednesday, it's the WFAE's public conversation, Unrest in the Queen City, 1 year later, marking the anniversary of the Keith Scott shooting. Get information about that and how you can be there at WFAE.org.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
President Trump is threatening to cut off trade with any country doing business with North Korea.
It's your community. we help you understand it.
Jennifer Roberts needed to defend her record. The challengers, Vi Lyles and Joel Ford, needed to show they are connecting to the average Charlottean.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Ron Stoghill about his, I'm saying your name wrong, Stoghill. Sorry, Ron.
That's right.
Ron Stoghill, editor of Ten Men, examining the passion and progress of black men on Charlotte's historic West Side. Two of those men profiled in this book by telling their own oral histories are Colin Pinckney, executive director of Harvest Center of Charlotte, and Daryl Williams, architect and founding partner of Neighboring Concepts and former member of the Mecklenburg County Commission. And your trip to the commission started in the Third Ward when you moved here from Louisiana, correct?
Actually, I moved from Denver, Colorado.
Okay.
I grew up in Louisiana, moved to Denver, Colorado, moved in Charlotte in 1983.
And you realized when you came, this was a time when the parks within the city were run by the city, evidently not very well.
That's right.
And they were, you described them at the time.
Yeah, well, even before that, I came here still with low self-esteem, graduating as an architect, but I still didn't have a whole lot of confidence in myself like I should have. And I started working with the young people at Earl Village through the Optimist Club. And that's when I saw those kids, I saw myself. And that's when I started gaining a lot more self-esteem because I felt like I could offer something to them based on where I came from.
Yeah, people, this is another part of your story. And I want to get back to the parks part. But the fact that you had low self, this is a county commissioner talking here. The fact that you had low self-esteem and that when you first became an architect and when you're in school to be an architect, one of the things you have to do, as you say in your story, is that you have to present whatever design you are to the class and your professor and sell it, essentially. You point out the good parts. You couldn't do that. You didn't feel comfortable talking, so you would, I guess, overdraw so that they'd be blown away by your art. And you wouldn't have to talk about it.
That's right.
How did you overcome that?
Well, as I said, I overcame it by working with young people.
Okay.
You know, I started working with them. And I was the only African-American in the Optimist Club at the time. It was a charter club, and I was reluctant to get involved. But when I did, that's what changed me, because I started working with those kids at Earl Village. And I got excited. I didn't care about nothing else because I felt like I can really help them. And I said that because that's where it connects back to the parks. I used to take them to the parks along with my own kids. And when I saw the condition of those parks, I got really upset. And I complained to Charlie Danley, who was the District 2 city council member. He got tired of hearing me complain, so he appointed me to the City Parks Advisory Committee. And I continued to complain on that committee about the condition of parks. But it helped me understand the condition of parks throughout the city, not just in my neighborhood, and how bad they were. And then the city and the county parks departments merged together. And that's the best thing that could have ever happened to Charlotte, because the county had a lot more money to put into parks. And so when they merged, and then a lot of changes started to happen in the inner city, but still not to my satisfaction. So when I was asked to consider serving, running for county commission for District 3, then I went back and understood that the county commissioners fund the park system. So that's when I said, I have no choice. I have to do this.
So I have to ask you, at the time you were working for Gant Huberman Architects, Harvey Gant's firm.
That's right.
Harvey Gant, former mayor of Charlotte. As I understand it, you went to him and said, I'm thinking about running for county commission. Did it surprise you? Did it dismay you that he said, absolutely, go for it?
It did. It did, because I was looking for an excuse not to do it.
That's what I gathered from your story.
Yeah. And they were fully supportive, he and his partner, Jeff Huberman.
Darn, you caught the tail of the dog. Now what?
Yeah.
Exactly right. You started, Colin, as a result of going to that high school.
Mm-hmm.
Which high school was it, by the way?
Olympic High School.
Okay. You're going to Olympic High School by invitation, and you you walk into this auditorium of, 300-400 young men, and you start talking, and they, after you leave, ask for him. They go to the school leaders and say, bring that guy back. And you keep coming back. You started, as a result of this, the We Are the World, or We Are World Class book club for male high school students. Why? What was the intended purpose of that?
In the beginning, the purpose was just to help, to be a community citizen who could help young men stay motivated to stay in school and graduate high school.
But was it to encourage reading? Was it to address a literary deficit? Was it to teach them stories that might help guide their lives going forward? What was the purpose of it?
Well, initially it was, again, it was more academic, which is, again, a shock to me because I'm not an educator in that way. But that it was to address a literacy need. What they had identified was that if the boys could improve their literacy skills and reading skills, they would fare better in school and ultimately go on to graduate. That was the overarching purpose, but there was also clear that the boys needed a sounding board, a space that they could unpack some of the realities they were dealing with. So in that way, it became more than just...
But you're also not a counselor or a psychologist, so speaking of burdens, your brother shouldered this burden at 14 of being the man of the house, and now you're shouldering the burden of being the man of the house for 300 or 400 guys.
Well, I come from a big family, so that wasn't, I mean, the number's big, but I grew up in a big family. I grew up with a lot of realities, and I've got a large family of my own. I've got 6 kids also.
Okay.
So, I've never been afraid of the size. It was...
But do you worry about the burden or the you're being looked to as a guy who lived the life and came out on the other side, and what you say to them really matters.
Yeah, and it was daunting, but like Daryl said, it's one of those things where you just realize when you're around these things enough, you've got to respond. It's almost providential that you've been prepared through your own struggle and issues, and I think, that it's a calling, and you step into it. It's not something you plan, but it was daunting at first because I didn't have a clue what I was doing. But fortunately, I did have a lot of management experience. I had a good career in business. I had a nonprofit experience. I had done a lot of that. So there came a point after I realized they weren't going to let me quit because I tried a couple times. I just brought to bear the skills I had. And then also my passion for young boys and my reality. And it became easier. It became motivating. It became educational for me. Mm-hmm. And it helped me capture things that deep in my heart that I've been wanting to do something about.
We've been finding out about some things about this city over the course of the last several years that are not very attractive. The low social capital score that we got, the upward mobility score that we got, which is among the worst in the top 50 cities in the country. If you're born poor here, likelihood that you'll die poor here if you don't leave. So there are not a lot of upward mobility options for a lot of people out there. You were on the county commission. Are things in any way better today than they were when you were on the city council, particularly for people who fall into that community of folks who are not just black, but who are on the low end of the socioeconomic scale?
I think overall our communities are getting better, the physical aspect of our communities. You can see the changes that are happening throughout
the
neighborhoods.
A lot of people can't afford those changes.
That's right. That's my point.
Okay.
And I think physical changes are taking place, but I know for a fact that the social and the economic changes are not keeping up with the physical changes, and it's pushing people further out, further away from resources and things they need to improve their quality.
So you got Colin over here talking to young guys who are in high school, who are in some of them, not all, in desperate situations, who are looking for a light at the end of the tunnel and looking to him for as a leader who might show them the way out to a better life. And then you're painting a realistic picture of this. We got a long, long, long way to go.
That's right.
You guys did it. What in your life tells me that I could do it, too? What can I learn from you that if nothing changes, and believe me, you don't have to take my word for it, you know this, things were worse for you than they are today for many people. What can I learn about what can be done in spite of things, even if things don't change?
Well, I think young people have to understand that there are two tracks. I mean, and certain people come into their lives, and it can be bad or good. Mm-hmm. And they have to be smart enough to understand the good from the bad. And they need to sort of, you know, get connected to the good and follow those people who want to help them become better and understand who's willing to help them and who's not. And I think if they understand that, and like myself, that's what I was fortunate enough to be able to do, mm-hmm. is to be able to make a choice and go toward the people that was willing to help me become a better person.
Nobody wants to be lesser than, and nobody wants to feel lesser than. And a lot of the, I think, problems that, this is my amateur psychology going on here, but a lot of the problems that we see with the desire to be respected and the resorting to violence when they feel disrespected comes from hopelessness. And I'm a person. Respect me as a person. And when it doesn't happen, they get upset. You're a guy who is successful, and you're talking to these guys who are looking to be successful or trying to find a way out of a terrible situation. How many of them are reluctant to take you at your word? When you look out in the crowd, do you see a lot of guys going and just folding their arms?
You've been to book club, haven't you?
Well, I wanted to also speak to that just in terms of the voices in this book. You know,
good.
I mean, and we've got a couple right here, but I was really swept away by the story of Damian Johnson, who is one, you know, a twin, he and his brother Jermaine, and they own the No Grease barber chain. And
right.
He talks about trust in that sort of intimate space, mm-hmm. that happens in barbershops. Here you're sitting there, one man sitting there in front of another, right, and he's actually getting his hair cut. And a lot of the exchange that happens, not just with the physical contact of actually just cutting someone's hair, but the kind of exchange that happens around life then. And a lot of those men wind up joining, you know, becoming barbers and working for Damian and having to undergo their own sort of transformation and doubt and issues around self-esteem and family dysfunction. And it really is about, you know, his efforts to kind of build a workforce. I mean, he needs these men in his shops. You know, these are the staffers, if you will, and they also are entrepreneurs, you know, themselves, and then they're fathers and sons. And so he has deep impact in this sort of this cascading effect that starts, you know, right there from No Grease, but touches the community generally. And during, and you know, people appreciate it during the sort of melee in Uptown after, you know, the riots, we'll just call them,
right.
You know, the Keith Lamont Scott, No Grease was the only, shop that did not get damaged. I mean, people knew of No Grease, and they sort of worked around No Grease as they shattered glass and things like that, because I think that, and it was just odd, you know, this one sort of anomaly in the community where people said, don't touch those guys.
Right.
That's the kind of effect they've had in this community.
So Ron,
and he tells that story.
Ron, when you sat down and listened to all these stories and you began to edit these stories down to size for this book, what's the common thread that goes through them?
I think that the common thread is a kind of resilience, you know, and an optimism. A strength, you know, and a humility, really, because most of these guys do not like get the, they're not out trying to get spotlight, but
mm-hmm.
they, you know, in the end have so much to share and great passion. And so, you know, that's what I got out of it. Charlotte is just a, yeah, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. How difficult is it, because since you're both, I'm sitting here with two change makers, how difficult is it to do what you do? if people are hearing you and they're going to read this book and you're going to share your story with them, how difficult is it for somebody to say, I'm going to do this too?
I'll make sure I understand the question. You mean someone else sharing their story?
No, someone else actually becoming a change maker.
I think this book makes it easier. Mm-hmm. You know, I think people probably can be much more of a change maker than they are. And I think when they read the book and see those of us who've come from where we've come from and see what we're doing, they probably feel like there's a lot of other things they could be doing to be a bigger change maker.
Mm-hmm. And but to even divide that even further, easy doesn't mean there won't be difficulty.
Right.
And I think that's part of our challenge today with young people, to help them understand that where we are, where we've gotten to, is not by lack of hardship. It's in spite of hardship. And I think that's one of the values that we're losing, and I hope we can regain through this, that we help the young people in our community appreciate hardship, that it's good for something, that it makes you the kind of person who is good for your community.
So I have about 30 seconds, Ron. You've written for the New York Times, Time Magazine, Business Week, among others. Where do you rank your books? This one, the last one, Let There Be Light, in comparison to what you've written for other publications in terms of its importance?
I mean, I've never really got a chance to just sort of do something like this. I mean, I'm appreciative of Dr. Carter and Johnson C. Smith for allowing me this hyper, hyper local, deeply personal, intimate portraits, no real gatekeeper, you know, and you know, everyone involved in this project, sort of, it was kind of a little fraternity, if you will.
And I have to stop you there because we're out of time, but the book is called 10 Men, Examining the Passion and Progress of Black Men on Charlotte's Historic West Side, written and edited by Ron Stodgill. Colin Pinckney with us, along with Darrell Williams as well, two of the men profiled in the book. Thank you all for the hour.